right, it is 23 minutes now before 10 o'clock. We have a book, and we never say this unless it's true. This is one that you will not want to put down once you pick it up. It is called Dear Mom, Dad, and Ethel, World War II, Through the Eyes of a Radio Man. It is a novel, and nevertheless, I think there's a lot of truth in this, and it's based on a lot of truth. Mark Stewart Ellison is our guest, and I believe he and is Eli his dad, Robin? Do we know? Do you know?
I can't remember.
Not really sure. Well, let's just find out for ourselves. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good morning, Larry and Robin. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank you for sending us the book. The book is really, truly one that you don't want to put down. Tell me about the title. Who's Ethel?
Ethel is my paternal aunt, my father's sister. My father co-wrote the book with me, Dear Mom, Dad, and Ethel, World War II Through the Eyes of a Radio Man. And unfortunately, my dad is no longer with us. My father served in the Army Air Corps between 1942 and 1945, and he wrote home some 300 letters to his parents and sister Ethel, hence the title, Dear Mom, Dad, and Ethel.
Okay, and he referred, did he sign his letters Don, right?
Pardon me?
The letters are all signed Don.
Well, we couldn't write this, it's about 90% true. We couldn't write this as a nonfiction because after 60 years, my father's memory was very good, but it wasn't perfect, and we wanted to protect anonymity of actual persons. And so Don Quicks, our main character, is based on Eli Ellison between the ages of 20 and 22.
Okay, and Eli Ellison is your dad?
Yes.
Okay. That's the part that I guess was a little bit confusing to me. But anyway, the book documents what he was going through. What is the significance of him being a radio truck operator?
Well, my father worked in the United States Army Air Corps, and more specifically, he was in the 327th Fighter Control Squadron, which we refer to as the 888th in Dear Mom, Dad, and Ethel. And Fighter Control was the world's first great air defense system. We might all be speaking German now if it wasn't for Fighter Control. Fighter Control was invented by the RAF in the mid-1930s, and it was the single biggest factor enabling the British to defeat a numerically superior Luftwaffe during the Battle of Britain in 1940. The Germans outnumbered the Brits in terms of aircraft by a factor of 4-1, and what Fighter Control did was allow the RAF through radio and radar technology to track the incoming German planes, get interceptors up into the air, harass, destroy, and drive them off. And if Hitler had conquered England or even gotten a foothold there, he would have been infinitely harder to dislodge from Europe. And as it turned out, it took 6 bloody years to do so. It saved fuel, it saved aircraft, it saved lives. It eliminated the need for roving air patrols throughout the UK. And the RAF taught fighter control to American soldiers like my father. And one of the first things that he does when he arrives in England in September of 1943 is start training at RAF bases. Units like my dad's were liaisons between controllers and operations blocks on the ground and lead airborne pilots in 5-plane fighter squadrons. They would help guide pilots to their targets. If they were lost or hit, they would help bring them back to base. You had 3 men in a radio truck, usually a sergeant supervisor, which my dad eventually becomes, and a corporal in a PFC who would transcribe, monitor aerial broadcasts, perform clerical duties. The trucks were spaced at least a mile apart to ensure optimal transmission and reception, and also to prevent mass casualty and capture. If a truck is damaged or destroyed, you'd have another one to move right in and the unit continues to function. Yeah, 2 types of trucks. Transmitter trucks would allow controllers to speak to that lead airborne pilot. Receiver trucks would allow controllers to listen to the lead pilot. Now, if a flyer was lost or hit, it took 3 radio trucks to locate him. What the fighter control soldier would usually do, usually the sergeant or the corporal, is listen on earphones for a signal emanating from that lead airborne pilot. And he would turn a little wheel in his truck attached to a 75-foot antenna outside until that signal reached the null or softest volume. And that would give him the angle of the truck relative to the lead pilot. And he'd transmit that angle by radio telephone to the controller in the operations block. And the controller would plot it on a graph. and he'd collect all three angles. The point of intersection was the pilot's location, and then the controller can talk the pilot back to base. This was called triangulation after the three angles. Now, determining angles was very tricky because the fighter control soldier had to listen very carefully for that null or softest volume, because there was a sound that was almost identical, that was 180 degrees off. If the fighter control technician gets the wrong angle, the pilot can fly out to sea where death was almost certain. In the 2 years that my dad was overseas, his unit, some 300 men strong, never lost a single pilot. One of the great unsung achievements of fighter control and the ordinary men who ran the system. This isn't a book about a Rambo or a John Wayne type, although my father idolized the combat soldier. It's about an ordinary guy trying to get along in some very extraordinary situations.
Wow, I have never heard that before. That is such a fascinating piece of information. The technology that we have today, we take for granted that it just didn't exist back then. You literally had to use the ability of the human ear to actually be able to diagnose the angle. That is amazing.
Yes, well, it's not well known because there are books on it. There are technical books on it. There's a book, for example, called Fighter Control by Peter Wickham, who I believe was either a controller or an RAF pilot during World War II. But it's kind of obscure today. It was top secret back then, and it still exists today in a different form. Now you have computers and satellite guided stuff, but back then you had the genesis of the world's first great air defense system.
Wow.
And what was really wonderful about it is that all the precautions that were taken that really put the enemy's ability at a minimum to find the pilots that they were searching for.
Yes, absolutely. It was a masterful piece of technology, and in World War II you have a lot of technology that we take for granted today that was first invented, amphibious vehicles, for example, the jet fighter, and so on and so forth.
Did your dad, before he passed away, did he comment on our involvement in the Middle East?
Yes, he was against the Iraq War. He thought it was an unnecessary adventure. And at the same time, he felt a kinship with the soldier. Whenever he read about or heard about a combat death in Iraq, he would have a very visceral reaction. And he really was part of a band of brothers. Even a technical soldier such as himself that was on the fringes of battle, fighter control soldiers were usually 5 to 10 miles behind the front lines. When the Air Corps would move up, the pilots would move up, the radio men with their trucks and equipment would follow. Even someone like him could appreciate the dangers involved because he did have a number of brushes with death, especially during the Battle of the Bulge.
How hard was it, Mark, to take your dad's letters, to take the factual information you had, to put it all together, and at the same time weave a novel around all of that? How hard was that?
It was difficult. I've worked as a reporter and a freelance writer, and writing an article, this is my first book, writing an article is a very different ball of wax than writing a book. It's not just in terms of length, but the whole genre. And this is a very unusual book, because what we had to do was, the 300 letters sat with my paternal grandfather, Mo Ellison, who gave them to my father shortly before my grandfather's death in 1961, and they sat in my dad's safe for over 30 years. And my dad would tell humorous war stories occasionally. He was much more reticent on the violent stuff. And in the late 90s, we got together, and we thought this would make a great book. So we took the best 100 or so letters. My father wrote out anecdotes. We fleshed them out. We did library research. We did internet research. I corresponded extensively with a Belgian historian named Jacques Winant, who was an expert on wartime Verviers, a small city in eastern Belgium where my dad was stationed for 6 months during the post-liberation Battle of the Bulge period. So we got a lot of local color on Verviers from Mr. Winant. And this process took place over a period of about 6 years, from about 1998 to 2004. And what makes Dear Mom, Dad, and Ethel unique is that it's a combination of actual wartime letters, a love story, and extensive historical research. And it details not only military life, but civilian life in four European countries. Unlike the combat soldier, fighter control soldiers lived and worked alongside civilians in urban and semi-urban war zones. Combat soldiers, by contrast, were usually in the field. So we take you to the bunkhouses and the mess halls, but we also take you to the London tube shelters, the downtown coffee houses of Versailles, the cobblestone streets of Verviers, the rolling hills and white farmhouses of the small town of Stombert. And as I mentioned, this is about an everyday, ordinary guy, not a combat soldier. So you see the boredom, the loneliness, the role of fate in life and death, the fear that the average enlisted man goes through day in and day out.
Yeah.
And you had expressed that very well in The Great Love That Was Left Behind, too.